What's up, baddie bees? I'm Brianna, mom, wife, serial entrepreneur, and host of the Badass Basic Bitch podcast. Each week, I sit down with a seemingly ordinary woman who's doing extraordinary things, and I get to share her story with you. So let's go. Buckle up as we're going to get real and dive into the shit nobody talks about. Welcome to the Baddie Bee Club. I am really excited for season two, Badass Basic Bitch podcast. And I hope you guys got to know me a little bit better, where I came from, my upbringing, my entrepreneurial spirit, and where it came from, some struggles that I had in the past and my viewpoints on body image and eating, and then being a mom and being a working mom. I'm really excited to be here today because today is all about season two of the Badass Basic Bitch podcast. And I'm just excited because it's going to be very similar, but also different. And a lot of it is going to be really more in depth of who I am, featuring more women, doing more in person, doing more videos, conferences, events. So I'm really excited for that. So who am I? I'm Brianna Dunbar. And I was thinking about this the other day. I have a lot of last names. My maiden name is Bubeck. And then I was previously married, and that name is DeMike. But officially now, Brianna Dunbar. And I am the host of Badass Basic Bitch. I spent season one doing it with one of my good friends, Courtney Shields, who's also my neighbor. And season two, we decided that I'm going to do this solo and really dive into the podcast and bringing you guys a new and better experience in season two. So really excited for that. So I was born and raised in New York, and I come from very humble upbringing. And what that means is the majority of my upbringing, we were pretty poor. And I look back at it today and I wonder, like, how did my mom do it? She was a single mom of five. And I look back at where we grew up in the house we grew up in, and we were all sharing one bathroom. And I'm not talking about one bathroom where my mom gets her master bath and then the kids get a bath. I mean, everybody in the house only shared one bathroom. And I just look back and I'm like, that's actually pretty impressive about how five kids all a year and a half, 2 years apart didn't destroy this house completely. It's still standing. So yeah, I grew up in New York. Like I said, my mom is a single mom of five. And my dad, who I am extremely close with now, had a substance use disorder. And when you have a substance use disorder and you're in a marriage and you have five kids and you're all a year and a half, 2 years apart, and you're trying to run a business with your wife, like, I think what just happened was, you know, your morals are not where you want them to be. Your values are not, they're impacted by your lack of impulse control from the substances. And because of that, it really destroyed the marriage and destroyed the family. And it wasn't a peaceful and amicable separation. It was extremely high conflict my entire life growing up. And to draw some light into that, my parents separated when I was in second grade, and they didn't get a final divorce until I was a junior in high school. So all of those years spent back and forth, back together, not together, hating each other, loving each other. Sometimes my dad would be there, sometimes he wouldn't, sometimes he'd move away for several years. It just wasn't a stable, consistent upbringing for me. What was I like? I was very much like my middle daughter, Reagan. Actually, like a combination of my two girls. I was described as like this bright light because I was very cheerful, optimistic, very cuddly and lovey. But I don't want to say manipulative, but like strategic. And it's interesting because I had to work really hard for anything that I got growing up. And money to me was something that we didn't have, but I saw the power that it could give you. And I think when I was growing up, I was very driven by the idea that I thought money was going to save all, like fix all my problems and save me. And I went back 1 year to New York and I found a diary that I had when I was like 9 or 10 years old. And I'm not kidding. It had my salaries year by year measured out to say like, oh, I want to make $150,000 by the time I'm 30. Like that was my goal. And I just thought that's really telling. And so it's interesting because I was always an entrepreneur. I always had this entrepreneur mind when I was a kid. And I remember when, like each season in New York, I would have my own business. And if it was snowing, then shoveling, right? But I was really little, like very thin. And so what I would do is I would go door to door and I would ask these owners, can I shovel your driveway? And it's like this tiny little girl in her full snowsuit with this giant metal shovel. It's like $20 or $10. Can I shovel your driveway? And of course they would say yes. So I would go block to block doing this, write down every single house that gave me money. Then I would go back to my brother and his friends and I would say, hey, I'll pay you $10 to shovel these driveways. So I was making like 50% net profit by scheduling these driveways to be shoveled and then outsourcing it to my brother and his friends. And then I would just walk the neighborhood making sure everything got done. And I would do that for each season, whether it was pulling weeds, raking leaves, doing the driveways. So I think that gives a little bit of light of I was always this entrepreneur-minded child that just had some kind of like charismatic being about them. Was I always smart? I think that's a very interesting question. I love that someone views me as being smart. And I think I'm a different kind of smart. I was never book smart. I never got good grades. When I was in middle school, I would have to take this sheet of paper around every week to every single teacher for them to sign that I attended the class because I would always skip classes and skip school and that I was did my homework and that I participated in everything because my parents were so nervous that I wasn't going to pass like certain grades. And I didn't really realize why school was so hard for me until I was in college and I found out I had ADHD and I was dyslexic. So when I look back at like elementary and middle school and high school, you know, I never did well. And it was just because I didn't know how to work with the disabilities that I had to make sure that I learned the way that I needed to learn. Once I went to college and we realized this out and I learned a couple easy techniques, I think I graduated with like a 3.8 or something. So it just goes to show like just a little bit of love and attention and understanding of a very simple disability to help fix it can make a really big difference. But definitely street smart. Common sense, street smart. I was a hustler. I could hustle anyone. My husband laughs at me because when we first were dating and we were doing bowling, I like hustled him on a bowling bet and I killed him. And he always to this day is like, you're just constantly hustling. And I think there's like this hustle and this scrappiness that don't always get correlated with like being smart. But yeah, book smart, no. Definitely other senses of smart. I'm going to give myself credit for that. Okay, why did I start the podcast? I was out at an event and I was in this semi-heated conversation and I definitely am a challenger. I'm not afraid to express my opinion and push back on others and just understand the context behind things that people say. And another woman in this conversation said, you know, you're not allowed to have this opinion, or like, why are you saying this? You're just a basic bitch. And I just was really taken back by that. And I remember looking at her and a little bit of shocked of like, did she just call me a bitch, but and also a basic bitch? And my reply was like, I'm not a basic bitch. I'm a badass basic bitch. And, you know, everyone laughed and it was funny, but that night when I was reflecting on that conversation and really diving more deep into the meaning behind that conflict that had happened, I realized that, you know, it's really easy collectively, especially as women, to view other women and just make this assumption about them based on their visual appearance or their outward appearance or what they portray. And I was like, okay, sure. I drive a nice car. I wear nice clothes. I do my hair. I wear makeup sometimes. I have a nice house. My kids attend a great school. I understand why this woman views me as someone that has no real life experience, especially enough to give an opinion about something that is very controversial. But that is so unfair, because when I look at what I have been through and all of the things that I have gone through and the hardships that I have endured and the life that I lived, it's very unfair, because where I am today is not something that was given to me. I had to work really hard for where I am today and what I have today. I came from nothing. And between all of the things that I experienced, like, I worked so hard. And for someone to look at me and make a very basic assumption of me is unfair. And then I said, okay, have I done this? Have I ever looked at someone and, you know, made these assumptions? And the answer is absolutely, I have done that over and over again. And that's unfair. And I think it came to a point of like, hey, like, I want to share my story, but I don't want to just share my story. I want to share all of the stories out there where we as women have looked at other women and said, she's just a basic woman. She's just a basic bitch. And I want to share like all of these amazing, extraordinary, badass things that people have done, because as women, we don't have a lot of platforms and opportunities to share what we've done. And I view myself as having a platform and having a voice where I can feature women who are seemingly ordinary, doing extraordinary things, whether they're the seven-figure salary woman who gave it all up for something that just made her happy, to the woman that came from extremely humble upbringings and turned her life into a multi-million dollar net worth, to the woman who beat cancer twice, to the woman who left an abusive relationship and finally got the courage to leave. All of those stories go untold. And there's all of these women out there that don't have someone to look at to say, if she can do it, I can do it. Because as women, our stories are only really shared internationally or even nationally when we are the Sheryl Sandbergs and Christina Tozzi's of the world. And so that's what started it. It's just this ability to share these voices and give women something that they can look at and say, you know, I can do that too. So season one, obviously I did it with Courtney, my good friend, Courtney Shields. So about this time last year, I sat in her backyard, our kids were on a play date, and I told her this idea and she loved it. And I said, let's do it together. And we did it together. And it was really, really fun. I learned so much about her and vice versa. Our friendship really just grew very strong. But it got to the point where, you know, Courtney is going to be more of a businesswoman and less of the influencer Instagram creator. And when you're running businesses, it's time consuming, it's hard. And there's a time that you need to like look at yourself and say, okay, how much do I have on my plate? And what are the things I really want to drive forward? And the podcast was something that it wasn't something that she wanted to like completely dive into because she wanted to give herself to these new brands that she launched in the same year that we were doing the podcast. And her and I just sat down and we talked about it. And like, she'll be on the podcast as a guest. She'll do happy hour. It's just the next level that I wanted to take the podcast. It just didn't make sense to have us do it together because the next level is very time consuming. So what do I want to do for the podcast for 2022? Obviously, featuring more women, more diverse stories, diverse women. I think that is going to be really exciting. More panels. Like, I'm looking to have where I'm interviewing three women at the same time talking about a subject to get like more conflict and different viewpoints expressed and more context behind a subject versus just one person's opinion. More in person, lots of video. I want to do everything video. Video is where it's at. I think it's just more connective and exciting. And I think the other thing about the podcast is like more events and conferences, whether they're in person or virtual. So lots of exciting things happening in 2022. So my eating disorder, how old was I and what were the eating disorders and how long did it last? I was clearly very vocal in season one in my interview about my eating disorder. My eating disorder started around 7 or 8, and it lasted until I was about 25-ish, 24, 25. So with that, it had a lot of ups and downs. It's not that I had an eating disorder like for 20 years, anorexia. No, it changed. And with that being said, like it went from anorexia, bulimia. But the most popular one that I was diagnosed with is EDNOS, which is eating disorder not otherwise specified, which means it's like a combination of anorexia and bulimia, also known as bulimorexia or excessive exercise. I sort of dabbled in everything. And I think if you have an eating disorder for 20 years over that span of time, you most likely are going to dabble in everything. So it started when I was 7 or 8. And a lot of it had to do with the high conflict, high chaos environment that I was brought up in when I was younger. And I think it, you know, it had its moments like peaks and valleys. And when I was 7 or 8 is when I first consciously remember looking at myself and viewing myself as fat. And it was probably a couple years after that that I realized that food contributed to your fatness. And then it was like taking action. So chewing food and spitting it in cups, spitting my food out in napkins, flushing it down the toilet, throwing out my lunch, little things like that. And then when I got into middle school is when it got pretty extreme of not wanting to even eat, being very OCD about the way I was eating. Like I had to cut my apple a very certain way. I had to chew it X amount of times and I could swallow half and spit out the other half, et cetera. And so it just got really obsessive. And in high school was more of like the binge eating because I didn't know how to make myself throw up at that time. So in high school, I went from like being very thin to probably being average, but at that time in my life, really thinking I was like extremely excessively overweight. And then in college was when the bulimia started. And it went from bulimia to EDNOS throughout college until I was about 25. So what type of treatment did I do? It was a mix. I did a lot of therapy when I was in middle school and high school. there weren't a lot of eating disorder facility treatments when I was growing up. And I also think that it was just so uncommon and not really well understood that it was overlooked. Like, being thin was not a bad thing when I was growing up. In fact, it was rewarded. You were complimented excessively for your thinness. People were very obsessed with how thin I was. Parents and friends and family, they really encouraged it. It was like this compliment of being cute. It's like, oh, she's so thin. Look at her. And so I never really got real treatment until I went to college. And when I was in college, I did an inpatient, an intensive outpatient program and like a day program as well. And the only reason why I did those things was because I was a very good athlete. I was on a full ride scholarship academically and athletically when I was in college. And I was definitely like the all-star player. And without a doubt, I got that treatment for my eating disorder because of what I did for athletics. And my school paid for it. My insurance covered some of it. And whatever my insurance couldn't cover, my school athletic program paid for the rest. And so that was the first time that I actually got real facilitated treatment. And then again, in my early 20s, when I was out in California, I also did an inpatient program that was followed up with an intensive outpatient program as well. What made me get better? I mean, I think it was when I realized like no one was going to show up. No one was going to show up and put me in treatment. No one was going to show up and tell me that I deserved happiness and that these are the things that I need to do to be happy. It was when I showed up. I made the decision. I was tired of it. I really hit rock bottom, and there's a lot of truth to that. Everyone's rock bottoms are different, but I distinctly remember my rock bottom day. And it was that day that I sort of had like this snap into reality of nobody is going to love you the way you need to be loved except for you. And once I made that realization of like, when you love yourself, you will be happy. And then I started making conscious decisions and choices that slowly got me into that recovery. And I think it's been over a decade now that I've been eating disorder behavior free. But I want to say that when you have an eating disorder, especially starting at such a young age, the thoughts and the mindset, like those don't just disappear. And they don't just disappear just because you've been behavior free for over a decade. I still have those thoughts. I still have body image issues at time, but it's what you do with that. It's the after the thought. Are you acting on the thoughts and having behavioral tendencies that are eating disorder related? And for me, I've been behaviorally free from eating disorder behaviors for over a decade. Do I still struggle? I mean, I think the answer is yes. Like, not necessarily the eating and the bulimia and the actual behavior, like the acting on the behaviors I don't struggle with, but the thoughts are there. And like I said, you don't just not think about those things when you've thought about those things since you were 7 years old. I mean, those thoughts started 30 years ago for me, and they're not just going to go away. Now, they're extremely infrequent, but it's, you know, sometimes you wake up and you have a bad day. You look at the mirror and you're like, ugh, what's going on with me? But then you can also make the choices and the decisions to work through those feelings and thoughts instead of acting on them. So in terms of struggling behavioral wise, like it's been over a decade since I've had any issues. Pregnancy and the eating disorder. That's a good question. So I've been pregnant three times. I have three kids. And I had gestational diabetes every single pregnancy. And if anyone has gestational diabetes, you know that you gain a lot of weight. And for my first pregnancy, I think with AJ, I gained like 75 pounds, which is a crazy amount of weight. With Reagan, it was like 65. And with Emma, it was around 55. And I think when I was pregnant, like I actually didn't struggle at all. I didn't care that I was gaining weight because there was like something very magical about getting pregnant for me because of the eating disorder and hormone issues. I struggle to get pregnant and every single child is with fertility help. And I think when I got pregnant with AJ, it had been years of trying, month after month of treatments, of hormone shots, of IUIs, of needles, of...
Luckily, during these fertility treatments, my partner and I had great health insurance. I couldn't even imagine what it would have been like to not have proper coverage. It's sad to think that some people are stuck paying thousands of dollars in deductibles or high premiums. And that's why I love CrowdHealth. Open enrollment is here, and it's time to start thinking about whether health insurance is right for you or if there's a better option like CrowdHealth, which isn't a health insurance. It's a modern way to pay medical expenses. And one of my favorite things about it is 100% of your monthly membership pays for actual healthcare costs, which helps the whole CrowdHealth community stay healthy while keeping money in your pocket. CrowdHealth is able to offer amazing prices because of its community of health-conscious members. But for a limited time, my listeners get their first month free. And after you've been a member, CrowdHealth will include a fitness wearable. That's 30 days to try risk-free plus the fitness wearable. Just go to joincrowdhealth.com/fit and enter code BATTY at sign up. That's crowdhealth.com/fit, promo code BADDIE. CrowdHealth is not a health insurance. It's a community-powered alternative. Terms and conditions may apply.
Just all sorts of non-invasive and invasive things that when I finally got pregnant with him, it was like I did not care about anything. I didn't care that I gained 75 pounds. I was just so happy and grateful that I was growing a human in my body and I was capable of that. However, after the human comes out is probably where I struggle the most because for anyone that's been pregnant, and I don't care if you gained 15 pounds or 115 pounds, the couple of weeks after you have your child, it is like sad body issues. And I don't care what anybody says. It's a struggle for a woman to look at like where you were when you first got pregnant and then like after the baby comes out and you're just like, what happened? It really is like a deflated balloon. And I think I definitely struggled with thoughts there, but I got myself into therapy and worked through the body image issues because I still had the mindset and the importance of I still have to nourish my body. I still have to take care of my body because even though I'm not growing a human anymore, I'm still feeding one. And I breastfed AJ for 10 months. And so I think just with the positive thoughts of my body is still a very important vessel for this baby now, I need to nourish it and care for it. And if I'm acting out on these thoughts and doing things to my body that I shouldn't be, then I'm like also hurting and I'm hurting my child and I'm doing it a disservice. So I have to take care of myself. And I think having that mindset really helped me, but yeah, I definitely struggled. Okay, so advice for someone that's struggling with an eating disorder. Yeah, it's hard to say because what I realized is like you're not going to get better until you want to get better. You could be surrounded by every single loved one there is. They can kidnap you and put you into a treatment center. But at the end of the day, like you have to be committed to it. You have to want it. And for me, what I did was like I started to look at where I was and where I would be heading if I didn't get help and where I actually wanted to be. And every point that I wanted to be, I couldn't get there with an eating disorder. And I think it was just to the point where I had to make that choice. And you have to be committed to it. Like, it's not just signing up for the treatment. It's going. And it's not just going, it's participating. And it's not just participating, it's listening. It's not just listening, it's like all of these other things. And you have to be bought into it. And if you're not, then you're not going to get better. So, advice for somebody who has a loved one that has an eating disorder, how to help them. It's hard because, like I said previously, that person has to be committed. They have to want it. You can't force somebody into it. And also, like, don't take it personally. It has nothing to do with you. Them doing these things to themselves does not represent their love or lack of love for you. And I think the best thing that you can do is just listen and be there and offer support. And not just offer support, but ask, how can I support you through this? I had a friend, and that is the way that they communicated with me. And it was just like, I would say I'm struggling, and they would just say, what do you need from me today? How can I support you in where you are right now? Versus giving unsolicited advice or being like, you're gonna die. Like, get better. Don't you wanna have kids? Like, that actually doesn't help. It just hurts. And I think the more someone feels comfortable and able to be vulnerable with you, the more you're gonna help them. Oh man, how would I handle if one of my girls or son showed eating disorder behaviors? How would I handle that? I mean, that makes me so sad to think about because my daughter's turning six and four, and my son is going to be 8 in March next year. And like, that's around the time when those thoughts started to happen for me. Now, granted, they're in a much more stable, consistent environment that's very loving. So I'm hoping that they don't have those struggles, but you can't control everything. And if my girls were to start to show signs, like the best thing I would do is I would be very vulnerable with them. I would tell them and share my own struggles that I had because I would want them to know that they're not alone in their thoughts and that I also had those and that I'm here no matter what they need. And I would also ask, like, how can I help you? Like, let's get into therapy. Let's get into treatment if we need to get you into treatment. It varies for like every single child, but for me, it's like I have this vision of like your arms are wide open. And I would just say, like, whatever you need, I'm here for you and I'm here to support you, whatever that means. If it means just listening, if it means helping getting you into therapy or treatment, if it means sharing my stories with you, it can mean anything, but I would never ignore it because the longer you ignore it, the worse it's going to get. So how do we handle body image in my house? Well, we have a couple rules. We never go on diets. We don't talk about diets. We don't talk about food being bad or good. We talk about food being healthy and unhealthy and that it's okay to have food that is unhealthy in moderation. We like the other thing is like, I don't force my kids to finish their dinner. I mean, it's important that they try and nourish and eat their vegetables, but like, I don't make them sit there and finish every single part of their dinner. And I especially don't do that to get dessert. Now, granted, if they're not going to eat anything and they're saying they're not hungry and all of a sudden they're hungry for dessert, then we can talk about that. But I think it's important to just express that moderation and like, you don't have to finish your complete dinner and then like dessert is a reward. Like dessert is just part of your meal eating and it's not a reward. And I think that's something that's super important where it starts to feel like it's a comfort food and a reward that kids start to view it as that. Like it's just part of the whole ecosystem of food and nutrition. And you're a lot, like you can have anything. You can have the cookie as much as you can have the broccoli, but make smart decisions to nourish your body. And in terms of body image, like I will never talk about being fat or feeling fat or feeling gross. I'm very like body positive no matter what it is. And anyone that has young kids, they know like the favorite part of my body for my kids is my butt because it's jiggly. And so they will constantly come up to my butt and like punch it or smack it or whatever it is because they love the jiggling. Very weird, whatever. But I think as a mom, there's two ways to handle this. It's the don't touch my jiggly butt. Yeah, my butt is so fat, whatever it is. But instead, I'm like, oh, my butt's my favorite part of my body too, because it's strong. It helps me move. It keeps me standing up. Like it cushions me when I sit in the chair. And I think those little tiny things make a big impact for kids. We don't like discriminate at all with body types. We don't make comments. Something that's really interesting that I've noticed that we do like subconsciously and not necessarily on purpose is when we see a woman or a man in an outfit that they shouldn't be in, that we make those comments and our children hear those comments and they see who you're talking about. And I think it's just really important, not just in the household, not to comment on your own body, but like outside the home or when you're watching shows, not to comment on other people's bodies. It's your body. It's your choice. So definitely that. The other thing that's really interesting that I want to say in terms of how our comments impact children more so than we know, I was in the car one time and, you know, I have a longer neck. I love my neck. I've always loved my neck. I don't know why. But Hunter and I started talking about that. I don't remember why. I was like in a turtleneck and he's like, wow, you look really good in that turtleneck. And I said, oh, it's because I have such a beautiful long neck. And he was like, you have a long neck? And I'm like, yeah, you don't see? I have like a beautiful long neck. And then I realized that my daughter was in the back and I turned to see her. You know what she was doing? She was going like this. She was seeing, does she have a long neck? Is her neck long and beautiful like her mom's? And it's like that tiny little thing could stay with your child forever. Now, luckily, it was a very innocent comment and I was able to navigate around that. But think about if you said something bad about your body and if your child is listening and then they realized, huh, I'm just like my mom. What does that mean? Am I ugly? Am I fat? It's like those little tiny things add up and they're like super scary to think about. So I think like in summary, food is not bad or good. Like food, all food nourishes your body. And desserts and sweets are not a reward or like a treat. It's part of the ecosystem. love your body, appreciate your body, and then like express healthy choices, whether it's exercise or food, and then really be cognizant of what you say and how you describe your own body around your children, because they are always listening. They're sponges. So I think those are probably like the biggest things that we can do. The other thing that I think is interesting about the eating disorder and like how we handle younger kids, and I think this is true with like addiction and eating disorder, that I don't know, I just want to share, is when your child is throwing a tantrum or sad or mad or whatever the emotion is, try not to distract with food and other stimulating objects. Because when your child is like really, really sad and they're crying and you're like, do you want a lollipop? And then that makes them happy. There is this correlation between these feelings and food being a comfort. And same thing with other stimulating things, whether that's TV or other fun games, whatever. But when you distract your child from feeling the feelings that they have, then they're never learning the coping mechanisms that are needed to process those feelings when you're not around to distract them. So when they're like 6, 7, 8 and in school and they're incapable or not fully capable of processing the feelings that they're having, then they either suppress it or they turn to other things that will distract them. And I think that's probably the other really important thing to help your child with is like when my kids come to me and they're sad or they're angry or they're having a tantrum, I allow them the space to feel that. Like no matter where we are, I do not care if someone is looking at me in Target because my child is crying because they want the toy. I'm gonna let them cry. I'm gonna let them feel that feeling. And then I'm gonna talk about why they can't have the toy. So I think it's just really important to allow your child to feel the feelings, but also like allow yourself to feel those feelings too. So I think that's another thing that we can do that sets our children up for success in the future. Did I always want to be a mom? Yes, I did. I think because I grew up in a family that was really like high chaos, high conflict, I think that there was something ingrained in me that was like, when I have my own family, it's going to be very different. So I always wanted to be a mom. And I also knew that I was going to have trouble to be a mom. Having an eating disorder that starts at 7 and 8, I had a really delayed menstrual cycle and I didn't get my first period until I was 16. It was never regular. I rarely got it. And so after I got married and we started trying to have kids, I knew that I would need medical help to get pregnant. And in fact, a couple doctors, a couple of years before we started trying to have kids, that was one of the things that they said with my eating disorder that really pushed me to get better was, if you continue on this path, you're most likely not going to be able to have kids. And so when I looked at like, where do I want to be? I absolutely want to be a mom. I want to have so many kids. That was one of the biggest motivators for me to get healthy to a point where I could get pregnant. How did I know I was ready for more kids? My kids are very close in age. AJ and Reagan are about 19 months apart, and then Reagan and Emma are almost exactly 2 years apart. Funny, because Emma's due date was actually Reagan's birthday, and I was like, that would be so cool to have them on the same day. But then I was like, no, I have to kick her out 2 weeks early because I know two girls with the same birthday is just like drama every year. So I kicked her out early. But yeah, they're almost exactly 2 years apart. I didn't necessarily know that I was ready for more kids. I just knew I wanted more. And I also like loved my upbringing to be so close in age to my brothers and sisters. We're all 1.5, 2 years apart. And I wanted to give my children that same upbringing and experience. And so I think I just went off based off that and not necessarily like this like light that went off and was like, ding, you're ready for more kids. I just went right in and did it. So it just sort of worked out that way. So working and being a mom is hard. When I started my first company, Zen Content, I got pregnant with AJ like 6 months into starting the company. That was extremely stressful. But the benefit of having your own company is you can take naps in the middle of the day when you're pregnant, which I definitely did. And I just allowed myself that grace of like, not everything is urgent, because if everything is urgent and everything is important, then nothing is. And I just viewed it as that point. And then after I had AJ, I tried very hard to do it all by myself. I was a stay-at-home working mom, and I was also like a mom to AJ. And I learned like within the first 6 months that that was very difficult to take meetings and plan it around nap time and have clients and like run a multi-million dollar business. So I had a part-time nanny that was like 3 days a week where I would put the majority of my meetings in there. After I had Reagan was when I had a team. I had 8 people that I oversaw that was working for Zen Content, and we had an office space. And so in that case, you know, it was more of a nanny that was working 30 to 40 hours a week. And when we moved to Texas, after I had Emma, was when I realized that this is so overwhelming that I decided to get an au pair, like a live-in nanny to help. So I think the biggest thing here is like, you have to give yourself help. There's a reason why there's a saying, it takes a village, because it literally takes a village. And when you're someone like me that's away from family and loved ones and people that can help out, then very unfortunately, like you have to pay for that help. And that's what I did. I also think that through that time and being a mom, I learned a lot of boundaries. In the beginning, I didn't have any boundaries. It was all about the clients and the projects and the accounts and the work. And a lot of people were put in like second place to the company. And now I like have very hard boundaries. Like when I have my kids on the weekend, like I'm not going to do anything unless it's like an absolute emergency where the sky is literally falling and the forest is burning. Like I'm not going to put everything aside to do work. And I think as long as you can continue to practice those boundaries and try to find balance, but also knowing that you don't have to balance everything, and that depending on what season you are in your life, you just might have to ask for grace from other people and say, I really need to pour into my family. And if that means I'm incapable of giving you the next episode of the podcast or making all of these deadlines and I have to push it out a week or two, then that's what has to happen. But also like the same thing of like, family, these next 2 weeks are going to be crazy and I am going to be working until like midnight every single night. And I just need a little grace from you because I have to do all of these other things that are super important to me for work. And it's not about having the balance of like, how do I do it all? How do I have the family and be the mom and have the job? Like sometimes you just have to give and take. So I think like there's a couple tips that I could give for working moms, right? The number one tip is give yourself the same grace that you give everybody else. Stop being so hard on yourself. If you like allow people to miss deadlines at work, or you allow their work to be delayed or not 100% complete because they had X, Y, and Z happening, then allow yourself that same grace. And then I think the other thing too is like scheduling. I know that like my calendar the next 2-ish weeks are jam-packed. But then after that, free space starts opening up. So what I need to do is go into that to like 3 weeks ahead or 4 weeks ahead and start booking, I don't know, an hour and a half slots
where it's weekly and I can go have lunch with my kids. Or like once a week, we do a Tuesday night dinner night, right? So anything that gets scheduled over those things, I say no to. And I have them in the calendar. There's something that like our family and our kids can look forward to and I can look forward to. It's like having that designated time. The other thing that I do is 5:30 to like 6:45, my phone is off. Like there's no email, there's no text message, no calling, anything. And that is just like fully dedicated time for us to make dinner, have dinner, and like clean up together. For the moms who are deciding, do I continue to work or do I stay home and be a mom? I think that's just, it's different for every single scenario. And the best advice I can give is like work with your partner and decide. So does it make sense? And not just financially, but for your mental health. And I think it's like, if you find fulfillment working and you can also do that as a stay-at-home mom and have like some kind of side hustle, or maybe you're just the stay-at-home mom that works in the actual school and you do like the fundraiser, the PTA, really like work with your partner and figure out like all of the pros and cons and do what's best for your situation. How is co-parenting with my ex? It's hard. That's about all I can say. It's so hard. I think the biggest advice that I can give someone when you're co-parenting is like, your children did not choose this scenario. They did not choose for you guys to get divorced. Do not bring them in it. Like, do not use your kids as weapons. It's extremely unfair for them. And so I think the best thing that you can do if you're co-parenting, and something that I do, is like my decisions are really based on, is this best for the child and not necessarily what's best for me. So parenting with my new husband, Hunter, is really, really fun. I feel like for the first time, I have a partner who like loves the kids as much as me, who loves being with them and doing things with them, and like takes this dad job very seriously. And it's just so amazing and touching to be part of it. I think in terms of like our parenting styles, very different. And Hunter and I go to couples therapy and we talk about parenting styles a lot, because when I, like, he entered in this life when I was a single mom of three and my kids were, what were they, like 1, 3, and 4, turning 2, 4, and 5, so very young. But I had been doing the majority of the parenting solo. So I was very set in my ways of like how to parent, how to communicate. And, you know, Hunter has very different styles and approaches. And it would be very unfair for me to say like, well, that's too bad. Like, I've been parenting, these are my kids, and this is how we're going to do it. So we really work together and find like the best style that fits both of us. And it's been, it definitely has its moments of being challenging, but overall, like, we've really, it's brought us together as parents and made us better. I've really loved all of your questions that you guys sent me. There are still so many that I have to answer, but I think this is a good start. I am really excited for season 2 Badass Basic Bitch podcast. And I hope you guys got to know me a little bit better, where I came from, my upbringing, my entrepreneurial spirit, and where it came from, some struggles that I had in the past, and my viewpoints on body image and eating, and then being a mom and being a working mom. I think the next one will dive more deeply into businesses and being a mom that runs her own business and business advice there, as well as relationships, whether that's with your significant other, partner, friends, coworkers, and business partners. So thank you guys so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. As always, thank you for listening. Check us out on Instagram at Badass Basic Bitch. And thank you to Saw and Sign, our production studio. We'll see you next week.